And once again, I'm talking with Jeff McMillan, the author of a new book called Delightful Lee, The Life and Music of Lee Morgan. And Jeff, of course, let's talk a little bit about the Sidewinder. I guess that would be sort of another comeback for Lee. Although for me, the Sidewinder sort of falls into that category of be careful what you wish for. Because for jazz musicians, of course, jazz musicians always would love to have a hit. But when they get one, you know, then they have to play that song for the rest of their career.
That's right.
And I'm sure Lee played the Sidewinder every night, just about. But and to me, his other tunes, and even on the release, the Sidewinder, it's the other tunes that are much more interesting to me.
Yeah.
But it's really, I think, around this time that he starts to come into his own as a composer. How would you characterize Morgan's style in terms of a composer?
Well,
because his tunes have a distinctive kind of sound to them.
Yeah. He really favored a few kinds of context compositionally, I think. You know, certainly he always really excelled in kind of a blues context, and the Sidewinder is a great example of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, towards the mid-60s, he really had this thing with calypsos.
Yeah.
And kind of a Caribbean flavor. And, you know, minor waltzes.
Let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned Helen. The lady that he would have a long-term relationship with. And let's talk a little bit about his relationship with her. What was that like? And do you think that she really had intended to kill him when she entered the club that night?
Well, I talk at length. I'm actually very close with a guy who was introduced as Lee's protege whenever he accompanied Lee anywhere, Kenny Sheffield. And, you know, Kenny knew Lee at the time when Helen was new in his life, and he always described their house as, it really felt like a home. They were very affectionate with one another, and they were very loving. And in 1971, which was, 2 years later, it really kind of soured, and their relationship wasn't so loving any longer, and they did have very violent fights at times. And, that's what some people tend to remember about their relationship, because, that's what led up to the inevitable ending, this sensational ending to Lee's story.
Yeah.
But,
kind of would be a great movie kind of
life, man. But, I think some people forget that at the beginning they were very close and it was a more of a loving relationship.
Yeah.
But, I think Lee or Helen kind of felt like a ownership of Lee.
And yeah.
She was more of a mother than a romantic partner at the end, so.
And so she had, but she had played a big role, I understand, in terms of helping him try to clean up his life, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very soon after they got together, Lee got involved with a rehab program in the Bronx and got into a methadone program to try to overcome his heroin addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And then, he started making a lot more engagements on his calendar for playing around New York City initially and then traveling to the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
I think Helen was a big part of that, getting him back on track professionally.
In fact, I remember, I grew up on the West Coast. In fact, grew up in Southern California. And I remember when he came out to Southern California in like 71, around the time when he did that Live at the Lighthouse recording. And I didn't get a chance to see him then, but I also remember it was either 1971 or 1972. He was getting ready to appear at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles.
Oh, yes.
And I just made it there right after he had performed, and then, of course, several months later, he was killed, so I never did get a chance to see Lee.
Oh.
But if we look at his last session, the last session that he would do for Blue Note, which it's called The Last Session now, but when it first came out, it was just called Lee Morgan. But to me, though, if you listen to that last session, he really was starting to go in a different direction. What do you make of his last session, man?
Oh, I think it's one of his most tremendous records.
I do, too, yeah.
I mean, I think it is definitely, in the context of Lee's overall career, it's really incredible. I mean, I think he's really reaching for a new idiom, and he sounds incredibly comfortable doing what he's doing on that record.
Yeah, yeah.
I think of tunes like Croquet Ballet and Afro Black. He's fantastic on there.
Yeah.
And that's not, you know, like Speedball or...
It's not, no.
I mean, it doesn't bring any of that to mind.
Yeah.
Billy Harper was, a very creative improviser and composer, and still is. And he really pushed Lee.
Yeah.
On that session, and that's what Lee wanted at that time.
And you could hear that too, yeah. And you know, because to me that last session, and because I remember when that last session came out, I can remember a friend calling me and saying, "You got to hear this new Lee Morgan record that just came out. It doesn't sound like anything that he's ever done before." And I can remember we sat up for hours, you know, one night just listening to this record. And of course, you know, it does have electric piano, which was kind of what was happening in the 70s, but it's more than just electric piano.
Yeah.
That's different about it.
The two bass players.
Yeah.
And Bobby Humphrey kind of
has more of a moto sound to it, you know, than just a hard, it's not a straight up hard bop kind of thing.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
And that Inner Passion's out, you know, with the
that's a weird tune.
The African sound piano. The very primitive flutes and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible stuff on there.
And so then I guess, you know, obviously then if Lee had lived, you know, in throughout the 70s into the 80s and 90s, he obviously then would have been doing some different things. Do you think that, you know, could Lee have had sort of withstood the challenge of Wynton Marsalis? Of course, that would be the time that Wynton sort of came to the forefront too.
You know, as you were asking that question, I thought of something that someone told me. This is Wilmer Wise, a trumpet player in New York, who also, you know, grew up with Lee in Philly. He said that Lee, had he not died prematurely, been murdered, he would have predated Wynton Marsalis as being an artist who could really do the classical world as well as
mm-hmm.
jazz world.
Mm-hmm.
And he feels that very strongly, that, you know, during the 70s, as Lee was really kind of getting back on track and, you know, becoming very professional towards engagements and record dates and things, that he would have resumed his classical playing.
Well. That's interesting. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, I don't know if I can see it, but you know, he knew Lee very well, and he was so impressed with him as a young trumpet student.
Yeah,
how Lee could really excel in that classical music world.
And really, you know, you would have to say that, you know, he was probably just entering into his prime, you know, when he was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happened to Helen after that?
Well, she was arrested and she sat in jail for a while before she finally made bail. I think she had some mix-up with her lawyer. And then, you know, she had a trial in 1973, a year later, and then did time. Unfortunately, her police record, or her the file for her police case at the county clerk was stolen.
Oh.
So I wasn't able to confirm exactly what her sentence was. I think the typical sentence at that time for manslaughter too was 2 to 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And that's what it would have been, you know, a crime of passion, or
I was going to say
not a premeditated murder.
Yeah, because I think they argue that it was, you know, extenuating circumstances or whatever, that she had not intended to come and kill
right.
him. But
not a murder, but yeah. A manslaughter. Right?
Yeah. Now, just in terms of, once again, I'm talking with Jeff McMillan. He's the author of a new book, The Life of Lee, The Life and Music of Lee Morgan. So do you think then that as we look back sort of at Lee's career, has Lee received, in your opinion, the kind of recognition that he deserves? And if he hasn't, is it because he died so young?
I don't think he's deserved the recognition he deserves. I think he needs to be talked about more.
Yeah.
I mean, he's such an accessible player. You know, his records, you know, it's no mystery among the musicians. They know his music. His records for Blue Note have rarely gone out of print. You know, the Gigolo and the Sidewinder and Cornbread, those records have been available since they were first put out.
Yeah, yeah.
Unlike a lot of musicians who come and go in the catalog. So, I mean, there's a commercial interest in Lee. It's just that he's not always part of the discussion when it comes to this, you know, list of players who are the innovators.
Yeah, they don't talk about Lee.
Like,
you know,
Ken Burns' kind of history of jazz. I think he's listed in there once, you know, as being one of the many people who played with Art Blakey, which is just, I mean, not to take a shot at Ken Burns. I think his efforts were great, but you know, I think Lee is...
Well, why not? Everybody else is taking a shot at him. You might.
I just would like to see a little more recognition of somebody like Lee Morgan.
Yeah.
You know, his records are available. You can go into any store and get them, and he's fantastic as a player, and he's been a true influence on the musicians.
Well, you know, and in fact...
What's important.
And in fact, when you talk about his records and his records being available, you know, of course, Lee... as you know, of course, he recorded quite a bit for Blue Note, and in fact, so much that they had to put things on the shelf, and some things didn't come out until, you know, the late 70s, early 80s.
Right.
I remember Blue Note put these records out, you know, with all the stuff they had in the vault. Why do you think that was? Why do you think they sat on? Because, I mean, they sat on the Procrastinator until, you know, the 1980s, which is just a great recording.
Absolutely.
Do you think that might have helped Lee's, you know, impact if they had come out when they were recording?
Yeah, well, he was... As you said, you know, he was just generating so many records at that time, and Blue Note was putting out other artists as well, but Lee was definitely kind of the most successful at that time. You know, they were mixing him in with some of their organ records at the time, too, which were their other big part of the business.
He's on the interesting Larry Young recording, in fact.
Oh, yeah, Larry Young record.
That's a very interesting record that Lee did.
But
you know, but then you know,
but
Lee,
Lonnie Smith, and you know,
but Lee was able to do that because you know, I think back now that you just mentioned that, I think back to the recording with Gretchen Moncur, Evolution, which you know is bordering on free jazz to some extent, kind of hard bop and free. But Lee fit in there just right.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a record where I think he surprised a lot of people, and you know, he always said that was his favorite record.
Oh, is that right?
Out of all the things he made, that was the thing he was most proud of.
Uh-huh.
That's what Jimmy told me.
Okay.
Anyway.
Okay.
And I think it's a great example of, you know, Lee being able to be so versatile as an artist that he could fit in on a record like that with people like Jackie McLean, who was certainly part of that scene and always excelled in that kind of environment.
And
Lee, you know, fit right in.
I was going to say, and he doesn't stick out. You know, Lee, it sounds like he fits with that, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And once again, I've been talking with Jeff McMillan. He's the author of a new book. It's called Delightful Lee, The Life and Music of Lee Morgan. It's published by the University of Michigan Press. And Jeff, I really do appreciate you taking time out of your schedule, man, and joining us here on Return to the Source on WJAB.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for calling.
All right. Jeff, in fact, I'm gonna leave with another Lee Morgan tune. In fact, it's from that recording, The Last Session. This tune is called Angela. You want to say anything about this tune, man? And this is one of my favorite tunes on this record.
Well, yeah. Jimmy Merritt was the composer of Angela, and it was one that Lee was really proud of and programmed into a lot of his sets. He was a very staunch defender of the cause at that time.
I was going to say, we didn't talk about, you know, his involvement in, what was it, the Art and People's Movement?
The Jazz and People's Movement. Yeah.
Yeah, where they went around and boycotted shows trying to get more jazz musicians on. Yeah. How did that turn out for them, man?
They disrupted the shows by blowing whistles and, you know, interrupting the tapings. It was pretty dramatic stuff.
Well, did Lee ever, you know, I know this wasn't his intention, but did he ever get on the show as a result of that?
No.
He didn't.
He appeared on the Soul program.
Okay.
That wasn't one that they targeted.
Okay. All right, so once again, we've been talking with Jeff McMillan, the author of the new book, Delightful Lee, The Life and Music of Lee Morgan. Jeff, have a great day. Thanks a lot, man.
Okay, thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
40% of coastal residents have moved inland, but officials are urging any stragglers